Welcome to the Lean Commerce Podcast, the show that sheds light on hidden levers that can help you 10x your business. Join us as we talk to experts and find out the 1% improvements that you can apply right now to take you there.
Hey everybody, I am here today with Dave Rodenbaugh. He is the founder of Recapture.io and just all around interesting entrepreneur. He's got a cool way that he's come into Recapture, and really looking forward to hearing more about his business journey. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Lance. I am excited to be here. And I'm interested to talk about some of the history stuff of Recapture. In the beginning that we were chatting there a little bit, you were saying that the path that I take here in Recapture was not a common one. So let's just dive right into that.
Yeah. So, you know, to give some context, one of my big areas of focus has been looking at acquiring companies versus starting companies. And I think it's a path that's not talked about much, really, as e-commerce or, you know, digital entrepreneurs. The narrative we hear often is, hey, you got to go out with your new idea. You got to start this thing yourself. You got to scale it up as big as you can. Almost downing the idea of acquiring something. When I looked at base rates, success rates, you know, most of those founders aren't going to survive the founding, right? They're going to try something, throw it out there, and it's not going to work. So you took a different approach. You decided to do some acquisitions. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got started in the acquisition world and where it brought you to today?
Sure. So back in like 2010, 2011, somewhere in that time frame, I joined a group of entrepreneurs that at the time was called micropreneurs. So I don't know if you know who Rob Walling is.
I do not. I haven't heard of Rob.
Yeah. So he's not big in e-commerce, but he's big in the single founder, small founder web business space. And he and his co-founder started this community called Micropreneurs, and it was basically for anybody, mostly developers, who were interested in starting, you know, their own businesses. But one of the things about that group is that attracted me there was that if you didn't have the business and marketing and sales skills, what the group was intended to do was to kind of level you up in that regard. Since there were a lot of developers of us, we all had skills where we could build something, but the problem that a lot of us had and still continue to have today is that building something's not enough. You need to understand what is it that I'm building? Does somebody actually want it? How do I sell it to them? And how can I do that sustainably over time and then slowly scale it up and build a team around it so I'm not doing everything and being the roadblock? So this is kind of what that whole community was around to teach. And over time, Rob and Mike Tabor, the founders of this group, turned it into something bigger. They created a conference that now gets held in Vegas every year. It's called MicroConf. And when I was a part of this group right here, I was excited because I knew that I had the capability of building these things, but on the other hand, I didn't have this burning idea. And when I'm listening to everybody else in the forums, they're all talking about, yeah, I'm building this proposal software over here. Yeah, I'm building this cool tool for developers over here. And I'm like, I'm not really building anything yet. I'm still kind of looking around. And it turned out that Rob was also, he had done some builds before, but he was kind of into this acquisition mode. And I thought that was kind of cool because it was like a quantum leap ahead. It was like a superpower. So you basically went in and you found somebody else who had some business that they had created, and you vet it to a point where you figure out, all right, do they have some fundamentals here? Does this thing have legs? And are there things that you can fix or that you can do better than they are? And if you figured those things out, then you could take that business and really grow it, which I thought was super exciting because I just didn't have that idea at the time, and I really don't. I still don't. I'm not that idea guy. My hamster that does the idea hamster in my head that's sitting there spinning around is a little bit lazy compared to some people's. And so I spent time looking around on various marketplaces that existed out there. So this would be places like Flippa or eBay at the time. This is, you know, almost a decade ago at this point. eBay is not really the place that you'd look for this stuff now. But in these places, I found some smaller businesses and I bought them at low costs, but saw that there was some potential in there. So I kind of cut my chops on what it took to acquire the business, to vet the business, to find good versus bad deals, to see when people were scamming you. And then once you got it, like, how do you build it up? How do you fix all these things? You know, how quickly can you do it? Which parts can you outsource and which parts do you have to do yourself? So, you know, that was a multi-year journey in there that I just sort of vomited out verbally.
Yeah, that's great. And so when you were, you know, starting with those first few deals, what kind of price range were you looking in? Is it like, hey, I want to buy something teeny tiny? Like, did it have any revenue? Was it just the idea there? Or what kinds of things did you look at?
They were very small. So when I originally had this discussion with my wife, she basically said, all right, well, I'm going to give you a $2,000 budget because if this thing blows up, we can afford to lose $2,000 and it's not going to cause major financial disaster and we're not going to be mad about that. Like, that was the number that she felt comfortable with and that I felt like I could find something to start with. I don't know that $2,000 would get you the same place today as it did back then. I think the competition's gone up, but you could still do it for maybe under five if you're looking small enough. But, you know, that was the range in which I started there. So I ended up buying a small business that did online cron jobs, which sounds really dumb, and it was, but it did actually have some revenue associated to it. They were making $100 a month. So I tried to grow that and make it legit, but it turned out that, you know, there were a bunch of fraudulent users on the system and a lot of people were just using it to basically cheat online gaming systems and other places. So they'd sign up for dozens of accounts and they'd have all these things that were randomly hitting a script on some other gaming site. So you're like, well, okay, they're not going to be paying for that. And I ended up, you know, cleaning up the platform, changing the marketing, changing the sales page, just introducing a lot of best practices that today we kind of take for granted. But back in 2010, they didn't really stand out as best practices. People were still sort of feeling their way. And I ended up buying it and selling it for the same price. But I came out of it with a lot more knowledge and experience. Second time around, I did that. I found a couple of WordPress plugins and I did the same thing, only this time the woman who was selling them to me, she basically had kind of gotten a tiger by the tail. She had written these WordPress plugins. People were really excited about them. They were using them a lot. And she just got drowned in support.
Wow.
They were just like hammering her on comments on WordPress blogs, trying to do support. And she was just trying to keep it up. Like, she didn't try to figure out, how can I systematize this? How can I funnel this somewhere else where I can handle it in a more consistent way? She was just answering comments on whatever posts she put up on the site. It was crazy. So I spent some time just revamping the site, putting on a pricing page, making things more clear, set so that there was a free version and a premium version, which she was not doing a good job of advertising. I put support on a forum. I added some email components to it. And I turned this into, like, from a $300 a month business to like a $3,000 a month business in the span of about 2 years.
I feel like your wife was probably okay with that kind of return. She's like, this one didn't blow up. I'm all right with that.
This one, yes. The first one was not as exciting to talk about, but the second one definitely got her far more interested in this whole thing. And it gave her some confidence when I came back to her and said, all right, here's another one that I want to get and I want to add it to this. Do you feel comfortable with that? I need to spend this much more money. And she's like, yeah, sure. And at that point, since I had an income stream, it wasn't even taking away from our personal savings anymore because I kind of had this thing going on the side. So she's like, yeah, sure, that's fine. As long as it doesn't touch our savings, I'm good. Do whatever you want. I'm like, okay, this could all still blow up, you know, but it didn't. So I ended up getting another one and, you know, that grew quite a bit more. So, you know, I had something that was low five figures at that point a month. And yeah, I mean, I was trying to grow. Each time I was trying to level myself up one more step along the way there with the goal of eventually ending up in some place where I was getting monthly recurring revenue, because these businesses that were WordPress plugins, it was more like sort of annual recurring revenue. There's a support aspect that eventually I started charging for, and that part you know, came up once a year for renewal, but it wasn't quite enough. Not, there wasn't like 100% renewal on everybody coming back, because a lot of people, they throw up their site and the thing didn't work out, so they didn't renew the next year. And that happened quite a bit, like 60% of the cases, 60-70% of the cases. So it definitely made it a harder business model because it wasn't quite as predictable. So I really wanted to move to something SaaS-like. And that's what had me looking in the e-commerce space, because if you're going to be, if you're looking at a business that is sustainable and desirable from the standpoint of an owner, you want to be close to success. You want to be close to the money. And on the e-commerce side, you don't want to install apps that aren't helping your store get better in a variety of different ways. And the one that I ended up on Recapture was like, this one is like printing money for the stores. So it doesn't get any better than that for both sides of the equation. I mean, it's such a stupidly easy ROI to sell. That's what makes this, that's what made this compelling to me.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, remarketing and or really a cart abandoned system is table stakes. And anybody, you know, like I just can't think of anybody or any reason not to have the cart abandoned sequence running.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to be completely naive at this point or living under a rock for the last 5 years to not realize what value that brings to the store.
So now do you approach it more like, hey, I want to have a portfolio of these businesses? You know, did you keep the WordPress plugin running and then get it to a point where it runs without you and then do your level up acquisition? Or is it kind of parlaying where you end up selling the WordPress plugins in order to raise capital to buy the next one? Or how have you kind of approached that?
I've taken more of the portfolio approach, actually. And in this particular case, I still have the WordPress plugins. I have a development staff that's working on the back end fixes for customers and new features. I have somebody that handles, you know, first and second level support on the thing. And so maybe it's down to 2 hours a week to kick all the issues that nobody else knows what to do with up to me and me to answer them via email. And that's more or less my sort of hands-off role at this point, which I think is a fine place to be. I like what the businesses do, and they're pretty easy to run. And, you know, we have systems and processes in place that make it fairly straightforward so that, you know, if somebody says, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, I can bring somebody else in and train them and say, all right, this is what you're responsible for here. And that becomes pretty clear, because a business where you are the control of everything in there, that's a difficult business to buy or sell. Because you can't take somebody's personality and pull that out and put it into the business for yourself. You have to have it something that is independent. And that's one of the things that I definitely learned along the way, that some people were like, oh, well, you know, we've got this whole business here. And then when you broke it down, you realize what you had was this person's personality that drove this network, that drove a bunch of sales, and that you might not be able to reproduce that. So
yeah, I've encountered the same thing where you have, especially in kind of this smaller profit or smaller earnings or whatever you want to, whatever definition you use for it. It seems like there are some amazing, I guess solopreneur is the right word for it, because they aren't very interested in building a team around it. And they make a good living a lot of times as, you know, solo workers. But man, it's just hard to sell because they are amazing at what they do. And I look at it and I go, nope, I'm not going to be as amazing. And any manager I put in place is not going to be as amazing. So it's just not going to, the numbers don't work out. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You got to figure out what makes sense there. And that's, you know, part of the whole due diligence process to figure out, is this thing, you know, when somebody says, oh, well, we're working 20, 30 hours a week, my first question is, well, what is it that you're doing in that 20 to 30 hours? And why didn't you hire somebody else to do that? You know, is that something that you will never be able to hire out at this point? Is that why you're holding on to it? So that, you know, can be a yellow flag, certainly when you're doing due diligence on a business.
So when you're sourcing deals, right, if you're going to say, hey, I'm going to start over in 2019, say it's almost 10 years later, we know not to source on eBay, but where would you find some of these smaller deals? And then kind of as you stair step up, if you say, hey, something that has a little bit of revenue. I was talking to a friend and I think that just some revenue proves that someone wants to pay for it, right, is a great step. And then, you know, 100, 1,000, 10,000, where would you source these deals?
So there's lots of little lists that I'm on that I found over the years. Some of them are, you know, it's very hit or miss as to what actually shows up. So there's like one called Side Projectors, and I'm trying to remember the other one. It's like 1K Side Projects or something like that. I can give you some links after the show so that you can put them in the show notes. And so you can sign up for those email lists, and then you see what's on there, and then they'll email you when something new shows up. And a lot of the times, I mean, what's out there is just pure garbage. It requires an unholy level of patience to go through this stuff sometimes, because people will say, hey, you know what? I rewrote Slack. I want $50,000 for it. And you're like, no. I'm not going to do it.
Not how that works.
Yeah. Or they'll say, yeah, I rewrote Kit for Shopify. Well, yeah, Kit's free. Why would I pay for yours? Like, this makes no sense. So it's just sort of stuff like that. There's definitely a disconnect in a lot of people's expectations for what they're selling and what they think other people are going to buy for. The one cardinal rule I found in terms of like buying and selling, that the only thing that truly adds value to a business is it making any money? There's some intangible stuff that you can say, all right, well, it took me a long time to build all this code, and, you know, I spent 40,000 hours or whatever, and so it's worth $38,000 because of that. But it really isn't, because if that thing doesn't actually generate you any money, it's kind of worth zero. The whole value of a business that you can transfer from somebody else is, can they make some money out of it? Now, in some cases, you might say, well, even though that's not making any money, I can turn around and monetize it. So a great example is like if you had a Shopify app. So let's say you've got a Shopify app right now, and what you want is another distribution channel for that app, and you already have that app monetized. You're just looking for more eyeballs and more customers. So you might find somebody who wrote a free Shopify app, so it's not making any money, and they want a reasonable amount of money for it, you know, whatever, $7,000. Some, maybe it's just an email pop-up app or something, and maybe it has a little bit of traction in the app store. But now what you can do is you can use that to cross-promote your other app. So you can get some leverage out of that thing, even if it isn't necessarily making money. So it's not a hard and fast rule of saying, well, it's got to be making X dollars a month before you buy it. Probably for your first one, you'd want that, unless you know exactly, like you already have an audience, you've got an email list, you've got a distribution channel that you can say, I'm going to put this out there, and I know it's going to be successful because nobody else knows about this, or I'm the only one that would provide this. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that would make me look for. That's the kinds of stuff I would look for in 2019. And aside from that, I think isn't there a marketplace now that Shopify is putting out there that they will allow people to sell stores, right?
Yeah, there is. It's a they called it Shopify Exchange for a while, and now it's just called Exchange. And it's I would say the beautiful thing is that you get some confidence in the numbers right off the bat, where you can just, as you mentioned, the only way I think is valid to really value a small business, if it's not super strategic, is cash flow. So you see some people who had big pops, and maybe their trailing 12 months is, you know, $50,000 in net profit, but that's because they had a $200,000 month and they made zero in January.
Right. So, red flag. Danger, Will Robinson. Yeah.
I can't help but wonder sometimes, like who buys these things? Because they're just, there's some really, I wouldn't say sketchy in the sense of like, they're not being dishonest, but I just wouldn't value it at anything, right? If it's a drop shipping store that doesn't do any revenue anymore, it's not that interesting.
So. Right. There's so many things that could be at work as to why that dropped off. So you had to obviously vet that choice as well. But where I was going with the exchange places, one of these days, I mean, there's been rumors of this for a while, of Shopify having the same thing for apps. So if somebody was looking for an app to buy, like, I would love it if Shopify had like a vetted place that we could buy and sell apps, because I would spend a lot of time on there looking for stuff that people abandoned, you know, people that don't want to do it anymore. You might be willing to take it over and then add on a bunch of features and monetize it, or use it as a second distribution channel or something like that. nothing like this exists, obviously, which is the bummer part. But, you know, there are places where people are trying to sell the Shopify apps. I've seen them come up on one of those other things. Flippa still is a possibility. I've seen Shopify apps pop up on Flippa before. But, oh man, it's like drinking from a fire hose of garbage on that site. And I'm not exaggerating at all. It's like you picture a mountain of garbage. Somewhere in there, somebody has buried a gold coin, and you've got to find it. You know, you're just sifting and sifting. You're like banana peels and used toilet paper. You're just trying to go through, trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. And that's what it feels like. And so, yeah, it can be an exercise in frustration and futility. But if you're patient, if you're diligent, you can find stuff on there and be ready for it and jump on it before everybody else gets it. So
you're highlighting one of the big struggles I've had as well, where you look through, I mean, even there's some great brokers out there, right? There's a lot of solid folks, but man, the good businesses sell lightning quick, right? Where, I mean, it makes sense. If it's a great business, there are a ton of buyers hoping to acquire a SaaS business or content business or an e-commerce business or whatever. And then there's a lot of folks that offer something that maybe has some value to somebody, but I'm just not sure who. You know, it's that mountain of garbage that you're really trying to walk through.
Yeah. And when I bought Recapture, I bought it through a broker. I got it through FE International. And they're one of the best ones in the business. Quiet Light's another good one. And, you know, there's a lot of e-commerce businesses and apps and SaaS businesses that all go through these brokers here. But when you buy through a broker, number one, things are just going to be more expensive. Like they don't generally do lots of deals in the five-figure range. Six is more common. And there's always a broker fee on top of that, which you can expect to be about 12%. So, you know, as a seller, you're going to get 88% of your proceeds. And as a buyer, they actually have a buyer fee as well, which is usually about $1,000 on top of that. So it's definitely not, unless you just have, you're shoveling money into the fireplace because you've got nothing else to do with it, this is probably not the place that you're going to start out. But I mean, the brokers, they earn their fee because they're vetting these businesses. They base it on their reputation. You go to them because you know you're going to buy a business that doesn't suck. And they have spent time doing due diligence, and then you add your due diligence into that, and then you walk away with a confidence that, yeah, this is a good product founder fit over here. Then I want to run that kind of a business.
I think that's a great point on the costs, but the value of a broker, right? Where they're drinking from the fire hose of crap for you, so then you can get a prospectus that looks reasonable. You're like, oh, wow, I see it's a real business. Like they only get paid when they sell a business. So they have kind of aligned incentives to sell the business, at least aligned with the seller, right? They want to get a good price and don't want to list businesses that are a waste of time.
Right. And to a certain extent, I would say that they're aligned with the buyers too, because you're not going to trust them a year from now, or you're not going to trust them based on prior sales if they are turning around and selling a lot of crap. So if they went and vetted all this and they sold it and they got a great price for it, but you know they've tarnished their reputation because they sold something that was kind of scammy, or maybe it didn't make as much money as they said it would, or you know some of the things that they said were going to be included weren't really included, or the handoff was a little sketchy. I mean they definitely try to make it, because their whole business is on the reputation. If they don't have that reputation, they're not going to make future sales. So they're very careful to make sure that the buyers and sellers are both a good fit. And I appreciate that.
That's a great point. So then, you know, we have the early acquisitions. I really like that idea of leveling up. Like, how much could I afford to lose? Because there's just a big difference between saying, I'm going to try a four-figure acquisition. We're spending $5,000 on this, rather than kicking off with like, hey, I'm going to roll over my 401k and like we're going in with $500,000 or bust.
Yeah, that's scary.
that would stress me out. So when you're now a little bit more sophisticated, do you usually look at financing deals? Do you look at doing all cash flow? Like how have you leveled up in maybe even deal structuring as you've gone up market?
Well, it's very much dependent on the deal I've tried to do. So I've done a variety of deals at this point. And one I tried to get through an SBA loan, which was an interesting process first of all, not every business qualifies for SBA because banks usually are very skittish about online businesses in general. And so you have to find like a specialized bank that really gets it. But even if they really get it, they still have to see a business that has some history to it. Like if it's been around for a year, two, three, that's a little shaky for a bank. They're looking for something in the 5 to 8 range that's been around generating revenue, has an established history that they can look back on and say, yeah, we feel like if we loan you money to buy this, we've got something that's not just going to crater overnight. And of course, that's not a guarantee. That's just the bank trying to ameliorate its own risk. And you can totally understand that from the bank perspective. So an SBA deal allows you to get something that's bigger, but at the same time, it very much limits the kinds of businesses that you can look at. So when I was looking for a SaaS, before I got Recapture, I was looking at this one that was an accounting business, and SBA was the way to go with it, but I ended up not getting it because there's also additional hassle when you get things like SBA, because now you have to go through SBA approval and they have to look at both sides of it. So they have to approve the business, they have to approve the buyer, they've got to validate income and all this other stuff. And so it can lengthen out a deal by 90 days or something like that. So if somebody's really motivated to sell, they're going to be like, you know what? I got another person sitting over here. They're just willing to do all cash or maybe a little bit of seller financing. So I'm just going to go with them because that's a lot less hassle on me. And that was one of the reasons I didn't get that particular deal because I didn't want to do the seller financing with that. In retrospect, I probably could have or should have, but it doesn't really matter now. But seller financing, I looked into doing that with Recapture, but the size of the deal that I was looking at for Recapture as well wasn't super huge. It was in the low sixes. And there was also speed of deal that was kind of a big concern, not just for them, but for me as well, because I knew there was a lot of pressure, other buyers that were out there looking at this deal. So when I made the deal, I said, all right, it's going to be an all cash deal. And then I took out a loan from my home equity line of credit to buy the business. But I bought it based on the fact that I felt pretty confident that this was going to grow. It wasn't going to crater. It looked pretty solid. Technically, it was a decent base to work from. The customers weren't going to go away overnight. This was a niche that was something that, you know, my wife and I were both comfortable getting into, and, you know, a long vetting period for that. But I've looked at seller financing, I've looked at SBA stuff, I've done all cash deals. It kind of just depends very much on what the other party is comfortable with as well. I was trying to acquire another abandoned cart business, and we had talked about some, you know, some cash and some seller financing. In the end, they just decided they didn't want to do that at all. They wanted to find a way that they could just say shut down, but we'll make you the preferred vendor for our customer migration instead, because they didn't want to deal with they were trying to get some stuff going on with investors and stuff like this. So this was all a distraction to them. And this wasn't like the majority of their business. They're doing something else now. So they were just trying to kind of unload this. So it very much depends on what is the other seller's biggest priority. And in some cases, it's ease of deal. Some cases, it's maximizing the outcome. Some cases, it's just knowing that they've got a good transition, you know, and they're willing to put up with hassle, to knowing that they've got the right person for this. Sometimes it's a mix of those, but you kind of have to feel that out. The great thing about a broker is you can just ask that question straight up and they'll tell you. So
that's a great point. And I think one of my big learnings has been, as you alluded to, like, people aren't selling for the same reasons. Some people are successful entrepreneurs that, you know, they say this six-figure opportunity is not worth it because there's a seven-figure one that I'm working on and it's just a distraction. And other folks, like, it's their first thing. They ran it for 10 years. They couldn't grow it past $3,000 a month, but it's their baby, right? And the value for them is really high emotionally as well. So transition is going to be a big deal. So great reminder there. Now, one of the other pieces, how many acquisitions have you done total now?
Oh, geez. There's been some bad ones. Do I have to count those? I'll count those. I think I'm somewhere around 8, nine, yeah, 8 or 9 done deals. And that doesn't count the ones that where I put out a proposal and, you know, things just didn't work out for one reason or another. And there's probably another dozen of those somewhere along the way.
Yeah, it's always a bummer having to count the ones that didn't work out. But I feel like it helps base rates, too. You know, where some the thing I want to point out is while it sounds maybe simple, like, hey, I buy this thing that's already running and life is really easy. It's not necessarily easy, right? There's no guarantees on these acquisitions, but it can work out very well if you are pretty diligent and have a process.
Yeah, and it's a process. It is definitely a process.
So shifting gears to really running the SaaS and acquiring e-commerce clients, I thought it would be fascinating to hear about, you know, how you sell a product that's not necessarily big enough for inside sales. And I could be wrong there, but, you know, with a lot of the work I do with e-commerce clients, we're talking, you know, 5-figure deals minimum. So then we can reach out. It's worth it to cold email. It's worth it to get on a call, do big proposals, things like that. But since you're selling a SaaS product that has, you know, good metrics, but maybe not high enough for your general user to be an inside sales kind of thing, what does it look like trying to acquire new customers for Recapture.io?
Well, I won't lie, it can definitely be a struggle. You've got to find the right channel. Now, the good news is we've got a high enough LTV that we can actually spend money to acquire. And for, you know, those apps that are out there that are doing things for free or near free, you know, anybody who's selling their Shopify app for $9 a month, I have no idea how you've got any money in the bank to do paid acquisition on a customer like that. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So having a product that is priced in a reasonable enough way that gives you the flexibility to do that has been a huge benefit for sure, because, you know, you can go out there and try channels like AdWords or LinkedIn ads or Capterra or I'm trying to think of some of the other paid channels that we've tried in the past here. Well, you can even just do cold email at scale and then try to find lists of users that make that, you know, are either agencies, so you can pitch a certain thing to agencies, or you can pitch something to store owners that's a little different. But all of that takes time and money. And, you know, doing that as an individual founder, like, there's no way I could do all of those things myself. I do have to hire out some help to do that and or run the campaign. And some things have worked and some things haven't. But, you know, having that money in the bank definitely makes that a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah, I'm also consistently impressed by guys with low LTV, because I wouldn't know what to do. Like, I'd be completely stuck, or I'd have
raise
to hope it goes viral. Yeah,
that's what you do. You got to raise it. There's no other way to go.
That's exactly right. So, you know, when you're looking at the agency versus the consumer, right, or the store owner versus the Shopify consultant or the Magento consultant, you know, how does that messaging change for the agency? Is it just, look, your customers are going to make more money, your clients are going to be happier, or what does that look like?
Well, it is for an agency, the pitch is less about ROI, in my experience, than it is about trust. Because when an agency sticks their neck out in a line and says, I like app X, and we recommend this for all of our clients because why? What the client on the other side, in my opinion, is hearing that this agency has vetted this app and that they recommend that it'll install it because it's going to be good for my stores because it was good for their other stores. That's sort of the subtext that I see within an agency context there. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that would be pretty accurate. Even when we've done referral agreements, when they say, hey, this other, maybe we don't, you know, we don't buy on YouTube in general. So if we refer another agency, it's not even about the money often, right? It's like, how can I give a recommendation that's going to be valuable? And it's kind of asymmetrical too. If I give a bad recommendation or a recommendation that doesn't work out, it can damage the relationship that is working out in other ways, right? I'm kind of on the hook for the thing I recommended as well as the things I'm already doing.
Yes, and dangerously so, of course, because of that asymmetry. You know, trust is, takes years to earn and seconds to break. So it the problem that I've seen with agencies is that they are very slow to act. So you could say, hey, I want you to recommend my app. And they're like, who are you? Why should I care about you? Have I tried you in a store before? Do I know you? And I can understand that level of distrust, because you need to be 100% confident that you send this person a recommendation and it doesn't reflect badly on you. If it does reflect badly on you, then you're going to lose business. You're going to lose referrals. You're going to lose money in general. So that's just not a smart place to be as an agency. So it's interesting. I found agencies to be far more conservative and harder to pitch to than individual store owners for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really like the ROI's got to make sense and there's got to be a huge level of trust.
Yeah, ROI is table stakes with an agency. They're like, yeah, you know, we know about a lot of other apps that do ROI too. Why is yours better? That's what they want to know. And, you know, sometimes you've got a compelling message and sometimes you don't. It depends on, you know, what's their mix of clients? What's important to them? Are they new level stores, mid-level? You know, are they like in the Fortune 500? You know, you don't really know. And sometimes they'll tell you and sometimes they won't. So that's a harder thing to do. I think I've had an easier time just going directly to the stores and say, you know what? Your store makes this much a month. I can add 10 to 20% on that without even sweating. And they're like, oh, you can? Cool. But then there's like other concerns. Is this going to be a performance problem? Is this going to break other things in the store? You're going to change my loading time? You know, all this kind of stuff. So in those cases, you're sort of like, all right, well, I can overcome those individual objections because I've seen them enough. But it's hard to overcome the trust thing. Like if somebody doesn't trust you, you know, what do you say? Yeah, sure. Trust me. Go ahead. Yeah. No, really. I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like a seat out of the Godfather at that point, right?
No, it's a really great point that, you know, you can handle somebody saying, hey, I have this problem, right? But you can't handle somebody saying like, you know what? I just don't like you. All right, you're really not the kind of person I want to work with. Like, well, I guess I'll talk the next one. The reason I ask is because thinking through the current distribution networks that get in touch with Shopify owners or just like, you know, what the e-commerce gathering points are right now has been a real curious thing for me, right? Both from the standpoint of sourcing deals and from sourcing clients. But, you know, I go, where are Shopify owners congregating, right? There's Facebook groups, there are forums, they're obviously on Facebook itself, right? So for paid ads, they're on LinkedIn somewhat. But when I look at other verticals, right, we've marketed into a lot of other verticals and it's just easier to get in touch with some of them, right? Even comparing agencies versus store owners. So it's always interesting to hear like what you see as the distribution channels to get in touch with store owners today.
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, the problem is there's no one answer to that, like you said. And even if you had an answer, that answer could change in 6 to 12 months every year. Because communities come and go. Sometimes there might be like one guy. So, you know, I don't know which Facebook groups you might belong to on Shopify, but, you know, one of the ones that I belong to is the one that's run by the guys that do Hey Carson, Jonathan Kennedy's group. And they, you know, they've been around for a long time. They've had a pretty solid community there. They've got a sizable following. But, you know, I compare the level of interaction and engagement I see on that one compared to some other Shopify groups, and it's very hit or miss. Some of them are more, which is very rare, and a lot of them are just like, you can tell it's the people that are brand new to the stores and they're just desperate for some help and they're not getting into the other communities, or maybe they're getting in, but the community moderator is saying, yeah, we just don't want your questions here because this is not that kind of a group. And so they might be like cutting them off or something. You can't tell because you're not the moderator, right? And because of that, the groups kind of shift and move. Like I've not seen any of them just sit still over all this time. They're either slowly growing and getting bigger, or they'll like do this little pop and then they just go dark for 6 months and you're like, what the hell happened? Slack groups that I've been a part of. Like there was one that existed for a long time called Ecom Talk. And then when Shopify came online and started doing their Slack group, it just kind of died. So you just never know where's the right place. And when you're starting out, like finding all these places is really challenging because there's not a yellow pages of this stuff saying, all right, here's all the groups that you could possibly join. And, you know, cause they're coming and going and you can search for keywords, but you know, you'll only get, I don't know, maybe 40% of them.
Definitely. Yeah. I know that when I started with even just online business in general, I thought, oh, this is amazing because it moves so quickly. And I still love the fact that everything moves quickly, but it's a real double-edged sword, right? When we work with some larger B2B organizations, they move a little bit slower, but the upside is they move a little bit slower, right? Where not everything changes overnight and you go, there's just fundamental differences in the business after a year, right? Even like your comment about marketplaces. If you buy an offline business, some of the brokers that were here 10 years ago are still pretty, pretty active on the online marketplace. You know, Empire Flippers was AdSense Empires or something like that for a number of years. I mean, you just see a lot of change happen quite quickly.
Right. Right. And you've got to stay on top of that all the time. I feel like I'm drowning in groups. Like I have memberships in enough groups at this point. I don't know which ones I should be checking all the time. Like I can't keep up with all of them. So then I start picking and choosing, but then I go and just sort of look at the other ones occasionally, see if I'm missing something. And I realize I am missing something, but I'm like, I don't have time to go back and fix this. So yeah, it's just limited time and attention, right?
Yeah, you're right. Well, you know, we're talking a lot about how fast things change, and predictions are always tough. But you know, what things do you see changing in the next 12 months in e-commerce or SaaS in particular? You know, you kind of have your finger on the pulse of both areas, it seems.
Well. Yeah. So predictions are often worth the toilet paper they're written on, but you know, they're a lot of fun and it's fun to be called out on later. So like I was telling you before we first started, I have my own podcast and my co-host and I, you know, usually have some kind of a wrap up. The first couple of years we did prediction episodes toward the end of the year. And then we said, here's going to be our goals next year. And then we revisited a year later and we're like, wow, was that wrong? Boy, that could not have been farther off there. You get like a 1 in 10 hit or 2 in 10 hit. You're like, wow, okay, yeah, I should never be a psychic. That's just not going to work out as a career change. But anyway, predictions for e-commerce. So so the digitally native vertical brands, the DNVBs, they are going crazy. They went crazy in 2018, and I think we're just going to continue to see that in 2019. So you're going to see more Dollar Shave Clubs, more Chubbies, more of those kind of very focused, we've got a particular message for a particular group of people and you love our product so much that you just can't help but tell your friends about it. I think we're going to see more of those rise. While that's also true, I think we're going to see a lot of Me Too businesses come in and fall flat. Because if you're not the leading guy, like so here, let's talk about fidget spinners for a second, right? Yeah, so fidget spinners, big disaster of what was it, 2017, I think. And you know, once everybody realized, hey, fidget spinners are the next thing, we got to get in there and get in now. And everybody's trying to do drop ship of fidget spinners. It flopped. If you weren't one of the first ones and you weren't out there in the first 3 months, you kind of missed the boat. And so, you know, the Me Too businesses, when you're starting a store that basically is just a mirror of somebody else's store and your only advantage is a lower price, I think you're going to struggle with that. I think those kind of businesses struggle now. I see those businesses show up on the recapture platform and they generally don't thrive, which is sad. I want them to be successful because obviously I want all of my customers to be making gobs and gobs of money. Then they stay on the platform and everybody's happy. But it just doesn't happen in every case. So you got to have a product that is kind of defensible in some way, which, you know, brings me to another prediction. And that is drop shipping is going to continue to suck.
Especially when eBay goes away. Right.
Right. Right. And you know, this is a tough place for, for people to be. And there's a lot of pitches and courses that say, hey, you could do drop shipping in 30 days or 10 days or 10 seconds or whatever it is that they're selling now. And maybe some people have made it work and maybe you can, but there's a wide wake of bodies behind you right now that says you might be one of them and not one of the ones that's still chugging ahead at this point. So I'm going to say that that's going to continue to be an ongoing disaster in 2019. And then the other thing is I kind of feel like Shopify's eating the world.
At least the e-commerce world, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're doing their damnedest to try to go out and basically take over everything. And I'm seeing tons of Magento people reconsider because they're like, well, I'm on a Magento 1. Am I going to replatform to Magento 2 or do I go to Shopify? And a lot of them are saying, well, I just don't need all the stuff on Magento. So why don't I just go to Shopify and then I don't have to deal with this technology investment anymore. So I think that trend is going to continue as well. And I don't know really where it stops. So I guess that's enough predictions. That's enough I can put my foot in my mouth about.
Well, thanks for taking the risk. I think it's always it's neat to kind of aggregate predictions, right? Where hear where a lot of people think something's going, and then just compare, right? Like, how were we right? Was it really moving that direction? And the Shopify one at least seems completely reasonable, right? I think that when I see how they're doing it, the only areas that don't seem to be moving on to Shopify are areas that Shopify won't carry. So if you sell firearms, then you're not going to be able to sell it on Shopify. But other than that, you know, just in looking at businesses, a lot of folks that weren't on Shopify who were on, say, something really old like Yahoo Stores, it's a great alternative to another hosted platform. But actually, I shouldn't badmouth Yahoo Stores, but it really is probably a little more current. We could just say it like that.
Just a little more current, yes. Yeah, but I think that's a good point. Like if you're on an older managed platform and you're struggling to get new features or to have existing support or just new things that aren't new to you, but they're not new to e-commerce, you know, maybe you're struggling to get abandoned carts on there. I don't know. But if those things aren't available, that's a pretty strong motivator to move. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are just sunk in their platform with tons and tons of cost. And, you know, I even have a merchant that's on Magento and he's like, I'm never going to Shopify. There's just no motive for me. I've had some of my competitors go over there and they got killed in SEO. He said, right now I'm totally on top of the world on SEO. I know exactly how to tweak that and keep me there. And as Google does little algorithm changes, I can maintain mine to keep up with that and stay on top. But with Shopify, he has less control over that. So he's never going to go there, but that makes total sense for him considering what he's making a month, but that doesn't make sense for everybody.
Well, switching costs for any kind of CRM, right? Whether you're a B2B company or you're selling direct to consumer, like switching costs are so high on the thing that processes your money and decides if you're heavy into organic SEO, decides where you're going to show up. So sure, that makes sense that it'd have to be a pretty big reason for somebody like that to switch. But for a lot of the folks who are starting, I mean, I can't see somebody kicking off with Magento today when you have Shopify around.
No. But yeah, that whole, the codeless movement, I guess, the no code movement, that's what it is, where you can build something without having to be the technologist that writes it all from scratch, that your barrier to entry is much lower because you don't have to be the programming guru to make everything work. You can just sort of assemble a bunch of things. Generally, they work together because they've got a vetted API. I mean, this is what Shopify has really provided. That's what WooCommerce tried to provide, but it didn't. I don't think they quite got that seamless integration that we have in Shopify. Magento did better, I think, than Woo, but you know, not as good as Shopify.
It's really interesting to see how Shopify is kind of like the Salesforce of direct to consumer. And Salesforce, when I look at the platform, right, as a CRM, they just connect a lot of other things. Like I can find a developer that's done the thing I want to do. And maybe I don't even like Salesforce that much, but I like all the things it gives me access to. And same way with Shopify, right? I know I want post-purchase upsells and cart abandons out of the box. Well, they don't do it, but there are developers that have gotten on the platform that do. So,
Right, right.
Like our friends at recapture.io. How
hey, can hey.
We come back to that? Oh my goodness.
Full circle.
Yeah. Well, Dave, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for the whole gamut of hearing a little bit more about acquiring businesses and just, you know, trying to scale up once you have that business acquired with that customer acquisition. If somebody has more questions for you, wants to listen to your podcast, et cetera, where is the best place to find you?
Okay. So I'm on the Twitters at Dave Rodenbaugh, and we'll leave that handle in the show notes here because spelling that is a personal disaster for at least 80% of the population. The other one is you can see our podcast, Rogue Startups, at roguestartups.com. We're also on iTunes and Spotify, I believe. And if you want to check out the cart abandonment, you are free to visit recapture.io, or you can find us in the Shopify App Store.
Excellent. Dave, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Lance. Had a great time.
Thanks for listening. If you love the show, leave a review on iTunes. See you next time.